Elizabeth Tudor, faced with the problem of being an anomalous woman on the throne of England, had to play her gender role in two contradictory ways. On the one hand, she was the erotic mistress of all the politicians and courtiers in England in her time. On the other hand, she was the virgin queen.
Was James the first king of England from 1603 on? Yes,
yes.
That's true. Is Macbeth, as it's oftentimes been described, a play that is designed to complement James as King of England? Probably we won't have quite so definite an answer there.
Gender, political power, and artistry in Renaissance England. This week on Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights. Hello, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen now for literary historians Linda Gregerson and Stephen Mullaney. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. As in earlier presidential races, the combination of politics and private life generated volatile headlines in this year's contest. But according to Linda Gregerson, a professor of English at the University of Michigan, that combination is nothing new, and indeed would be completely familiar in Elizabethan England. Elizabeth I was known as the Virgin Queen, and she reigned over England and Ireland for more than 40 years before her death in 1603. I asked Linda Gregerson to describe how questions of gender, sexuality, and political power conflated in Elizabethan England.
Well, there were many things peculiar to the reign of Elizabeth that were particular sort of problems and pressures on that monarchy. One is the anomaly of having a female prince. This was a time...
Not a princess, but a prince.
Not a princess, a female prince. All the sort of theories of monarchy were predicated upon patriarchal premises.
Oh, you told me that it was unregenerate, it was
unregenerate,
heavy-handed.
Absolutely.
Difficult.
And so there were, I mean, the people of power in the kingdom were for the most part men. They were not used to serving under a queen. There had been a recent reign, one very short, 5 years long, by Elizabeth's sister that had not gone well at all. That queen is known to us now as Bloody Mary.
Right.
And so there was a lot that had to be negotiated about this. It was really an anomalous circumstance.
All right, now how do questions of sexuality, gender, to get right to the point here, the virginity of the queen, all of this on the public mind. These weren't things that were talked about. They were talked about in secret, but they were very much a part of Elizabethan politics.
Absolutely. They were very explicit. They were the explicit means by which Elizabeth and her managers, statesmen, spin control experts, and so forth, managed what has come to be called the cult of Elizabeth, managed both the image and the day-to-day workings of power.
Tell me about the Spanish Armada, the English triumph, the Spanish lose, we have a big storm that comes up, and a portrait of Elizabeth comes out of that. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, late in the reign of Elizabeth, and increasingly as she aged, the iconography associated, the sort of set of symbols associated with the queen, emphasized her virginity. This was a default virginity in many respects. She'd been expected to marry for decades and decades and decades, had not. So her counselors and the government and she thought they may as well capitalize on this, and we came to have a cult of virginity as well in England. In 1588, England came very close to being invaded by the Spanish Armada. It was a real danger. The Spanish were much more powerful than the English. A storm scattered the English Armada. And as a way of sort of marketing that victory, an equation was drawn between the Queen's own intact body and the intact island nation of England.
All right, now to the English sensibility of this time, the Queen was a person, to be sure. She embodied political power, but she also mystically embodied the whole notion of what it meant to be English, and her sexuality was a part of that question.
Well, it certainly was. I mean, on very pragmatic terms, the question of the succession of Elizabeth's body, what that body naturally was called, and what that body, whether that body could produce a child who would inherit the throne of England, was a very real question. You have to remember that it was only with the reign of Elizabeth's grandfather, Henry VII, the first Tudor king of England, that that long, long series of civil contentions, very bloody civil wars, called the Wars of the Roses, mm-hmm. had ended. It was very important in real pragmatic terms for this country to have a clear heir to the throne.
All right, now that brought in a long series of successes. Of what political stabilities?
Absolutely.
Why, therefore, would the Queen's sexuality, her gender, the connection between gender and politics, why would that be so volatile in the minds of these English people?
Well, two reasons, chiefly. One is that Elizabeth was pressured very explicitly by Parliament to marry. Mm-hmm. It was the
if
first thing.
If you want
Parliament
money, you've got to get married.
That's right. She would have to call Parliament because she needed money to conduct wars, to conduct her day-to-day business, and they would say, we'll give you money, but you must marry. It was an enormous, it was an continuing battle. So there was a whole question. There were series of marriage negotiations with Protestant princes, with Catholic princes of Europe, with the nobility of England, and all of this was any single alliance threatened to upset a balance and threatened a lot of people.
All right, now tell me about John Stubbs, a Puritan who inveighs against the Queen herself because it appears that she's going to marry a Frenchman who's 20 years younger. Boy, this sounds like politics in the, you know, Geraldo and Oprah and Phil
well,
and all of that?
When Elizabeth was 46 years old, this is the sort of last great effort to marry her off. And the marriage negotiations were resumed with France, proposing to marry Elizabeth to the Duke of Anjou, who was 20 years her junior.
And Stubbs really takes after this
This
guy.
Was seen as very threatening uh-huh. to the Protestant faction in England. France was identified with the Catholic Church, even though Anjou had credentials as a Protestant. He'd fought on behalf of the Huguenots and so forth. That was not perceived as a secure alliance. And people like John Stubbs, a Puritan, imagined that England would simply be swallowed up in what he called a gaping gulf. His pamphlet was called A Gaping Gulf. And that gaping gulf was, you know, the whole decadent Whore of Babylon, Roman Catholic affiliation of France.
All right. Now Stubbs lost his right hand as a matter of fact. I mean, in writing this thing. But he was nonetheless loyal to Elizabeth. That tells us a lot, doesn't it? About, all these cross currents and difficulties. Nonetheless, these people stayed loyal to their queen.
This was a very, it's a very famous scaffold scene. This was a highly incautious pamphlet published in 1579. It took great liberties with Elizabeth's person. It speculated about her capacity to bear children, her capacity to attract the legitimate sexual interest of a potential husband, etc., etc. Stubbs had his right hand cut off. On the scaffold, he gave a speech in which he said, I'm very sorry to lose my hand, but I am sorrier yet that I lose it by judgment.
Is it, Linda, is it because all of this is so distant in time that it is somehow easier for us to trace the line between the public and the private in this Elizabethan political setting, whereas today we look around and we think how trivial, how cheap, how tawdry all of this becomes when we talk about sex or politics, sex and politics?
I don't think it's necessarily easier to draw the line. It was not for contemporaries in the 16th century, nor is it to us retrospectively, but the forces that governed a lot of this public discourse, a lot of the sort of the gossip and the political maneuvering and so forth, even the violence, the field of forces seems to me, in any case, to be far more complex. It was about many more things. It was about the real transmission of power. It was about the Protestant-Catholic divisions in in Europe. It was about the Reformation and a lot of people wanting to secure the stability of the Reformation.
In other words, today we deal in, trivial may not be the right word, but we don't deal substantively with our politics compared to the substantive issues that you're discussing here.
The place of...
I mean, our problems are real, aren't they?
The place of our speculations about the private sexual goings-on of political candidates, I think, is cast very differently than speculations in this period, simply because we don't have a monarchy. The whole theory and ground of monarchy in this period was a theory that had medieval sources in the theory of the king's two bodies. There was a natural body, a body natural, and a body mystical, which was the corporate body, the nation. That gets a little dicey when you're going to transfer it to the female body, but in some ways even more aggravated. We don't have such a theory, despite our, the public broadcast of George Bush's colonoscopies and so forth. It's a very different kind of set of stakes.
Is it possible to look back in time, Linda Gregerson, and say that there is an ideology of feminism that we should associate accurately with the question of sexuality and gender and the reign of Elizabeth? Or, on the other hand, is that the sort of thing that scholars are moving from our time back to that time?
There certainly are very, very real gender politics at stake in this period. We can't call Elizabeth a feminist, though it would be nice to be able to do so. She by no means worked very coherently for the liberation of her gender. She was, not to put too fine a point on it, she was hell on the other women around her, women of the period.
She
never made a
claim. She says, I may be a woman, but I reign.
When she was speaking to the troops before the Spanish invasion, she said, I may have the weak and feeble body of a woman, but I have the heart and soul of a king and a king of England, too. Her claims were based on patriarchy. The parent she identified with in public was her father, not her mother. Uh-huh. She made claims to be the exception. She was not making claims on behalf of her sex and its capacity to rule. Never. It was more that she was, because the theory was of divine right monarchy, it was, patriarchy was endorsed by religious precedent, et cetera, but God could invest an exception.
Linda, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Let me ask you to speculate. Suppose she were sitting here at a third microphone. What would you say to Elizabeth the Queen in this enormous knot here of sex and politics and power and all these things you've been talking about?
Well, myself, I'm afraid I'd probably ask something exceedingly colorless the political bureaucracy, and it would have to do with her counselor, William Cecil. The question, of course, much of humanity has wished to ask of the Queen is about this question of her virginity.
Why should we ask such a question?
Well, why has it been asked? The ways in which her sex never was minimized is the way in which she capitalized on a very public, a publicly eroticized persona. She expected to be addressed as the mistress, the Petrarchan mistress of all her courtiers, and indeed was. They wrote love poetry to her. They paid homage to her. They talked until she was 70 years old. They addressed her as beautiful and fair and a timeless cynosure of female sexuality.
Well, Linda, I want to thank you for your colorful and vivid presentation of Queen Elizabeth. You are a professor of English at the University of Michigan. You've been here at our Humanities Center working on a project about Spencer and Milton. Linda, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Good luck in your work.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Artistry and Politics in Renaissance England. Join me now for a conversation with literary historian Stephen Mullaney, a professor of English at the University of Michigan. Stephen Mullaney is the author of The Place of the Stage, subtitled License, Play, and Power in Renaissance England. In his approach to those themes, Stephen Mullaney employs what scholars call the new historicism, a broad-based effort to consider historical cultures as dynamic and constantly subject to political negotiation. To make that abstraction concrete, I asked Stephen Mullaney to begin his discussion with an anecdote, the story of the Earl of Gowrie and his attempt to assassinate King James VI.
Okay, this story has some surprising characteristics from our point of view that aren't surprising at all for the Renaissance, and that's one of the reasons for starting with it. The Earl of Gowrie, while hosting James as his house guest, attempted to assassinate him. He was cut down in the attempt.
Not a very hospitable thing to do.
Okay. But one of the unusual things, especially for us, but less so for the period, was that, according to the official account of his death, his body didn't bleed, although he was stabbed a number of times.
His body didn't bleed?
Until James, then James VI of Scotland, this is before James became King of England, until James, a king who prided himself on being able to spy into the secret of things, searched the body, found a parchment bag full of riddles and magic enchantments, removed it, the body bled.
Now, wait a minute. This is supposed to be the Renaissance, when everybody's eyes are beginning to open to the power of reason, and it sounds to me like you're describing a world of magic and mystery, clearly medieval.
Well, the Renaissance is a transition period, and part of what anyone doing any form of cultural history, whether it calls itself new historicism or anything else, has to do is to try to make sure that the unfamiliar and the strange aspects of the period aren't lost in looking for what provides a continuity with us.
All right, well, now let's pursue the story. Let's pursue this anecdote a little bit more. I mean, why is that important, that the king himself had to pronounce, or as it were, make this discovery so that this assassination arrested would make sense to a then-contemporary audience?
Well, among the things this story is important for is that this is the story James once told about his own powers.
We got PR at work here. Huh?
And what happened with me when I started working with both incidents of treason in the period, uprisings, rebellions, attempted regicides, and also wanting to find a way to work with Macbeth, the play, mm-hmm. in new ways, I began to encounter, with almost every account of treason in the period, some mention of especially riddles, riddling prophecies, ambiguous prophecies of exactly the sort that show up mm-hmm. in the play, Macbeth.
So we got the three witches.
Right. James, in the Gowrie story, which was written with his stamp of approval, uh-huh. is declaring his power over such phenomenon, which are widely reported, widely believed. One of the points of Macbeth, I think, is that James has no such power. Macbeth has a complicated history with that attempt on James's life, too, though.
Well, does this mean that Shakespeare was being subversive politically, that he was, as it were, sassing the king in making a statement like that?
Subversive is probably too strong a word, but he's subjecting to a rather critical and fantastic, in every sense of the word, treatment mm-hmm. in that play, some of James's pretensions to power beyond his scope.
Let's step back from Macbeth and James and Shakespeare. Why was popular drama during this period, why was it a cultural contradiction? That's a phrase that you use in this book.
Yeah, I'm not sure I say it in and of itself, in its essence, is a cultural contradiction. However, it was born of a number of cultural contradictions in the period, of a clash between court power and city power. City of London wanted very much to get rid of all forms of popular drama, and its efforts to ban popular drama were one of the reasons it developed into such a rich cultural phenomenon that it did.
We have the problem here of popular opinion, don't we? I mean, that's something that we like to think of as very modern, and yet you're telling me here it is back in the Renaissance.
Well, for a very brief period of time in Renaissance London, a form of drama emerged, partly because there was an effort to suppress it, and it was forced to find a place where it could exist.
And this was the liberties of London.
Outside the city walls of London, yeah.
All right.
An area outside the city walls, which in fact for three or four centuries had existed as precisely the place where the city itself allowed anything it couldn't quite contain within the strict binary order of the city walled, of the walled city itself, allowed to exist or maintained by ritual means. A great deal of things the culture was ambivalent about.
It reminds me, I mean, let's not push it too far, Steve Mullaney, but it's almost like a circus in the modern world. This is that thing that is strange and weird, and we let it move around, and we give it a place and give it a name and acknowledge that strangeness, but we contain it nonetheless.
Well, actually, modern circuses are, you know, if you trace them back, that's where they would have taken place, is out there in the Liberties. Mm-hmm. That's where marketplaces took place, too, though, because markets were places where foreigners came to the city proper to trade, to negotiate. Uh-huh. The Liberties were a place where the strange, the foreign, the otherworldly, too, was negotiated with the everyday.
Let me ask you to reflect on what seems to be, speaking of contradictions, a great paradox here, Steve. I mean, we look back to the Renaissance and we think here is the basis for our received notion of what we call the canonical. I mean, here's our Shakespeare back there on that horizon. And you're telling me that if not in every play, there are elements in Shakespearean drama that are directly counter to the whole notion of authority and state ideology, that it's anything but what we today would call canonical.
Well, this is one of the reasons for the need to return one to the unfamiliar aspects of the period, because Shakespeare is the emblem of high culture in our day and age.
Right.
In Shakespeare's own day and age, Shakespeare, the theaters he wrote for, the drama he himself wrote, but in all the drama his contemporaries wrote, was not even regarded as art.
Okay? Is that why he wasn't remembered?
Shakespeare was fairly well remembered. Popular drama, Elizabethan and Jacobean times, was quite controversial. What was controversial wasn't whether it was a form of art or not, because it was pretty clear to them it wasn't really. Drama was not dignified enough. Drama that played to the entire spectrum of society, as this drama did, was not dignified enough to be what we would call literature.
Uh-huh.
What the period was sure of was that it was dangerous, content aside. Okay? The popular theaters that sprung up outside the city walls could not be put down by the city. Every apprentice that could afford admission, and we don't know how some of them did, but they did afford admission to the theater,
mm-hmm.
standing space only, went out, supported a large number of theaters, a wide repertory of drama, a large number of acting companies for a 30 or 40 year period. That's amazing. What the city knew was that this was a place where all those people went and gathered, and they learned dangerous ideas possibly too. But the gathering of the populace alone, in an unregulated fashion, somewhere other than at church, which is the only other place you would find such
right.
gatherings, quite in a highly hierarchical society, the most dangerous thing imaginable.
What you're doing, what you're urging us to do, Steve Mullaney, is to reconsider what we call literature. You are teasing out of that many more meanings, many more subtleties than we want to attribute to it and leave it there monolithically back on the horizon. Am I right?
Well, I would say the way to make, whether it's literature, whether it's art, painting, whether it's music, whatever it is, the way to make it timely for us
yeah.
isn't to make it timeless. The timeless is dead.
Fair enough.
The way to make it timely is to make it rich.
Uh-huh.
And one way to make it rich is to see what its range of potential power and effective force was in its own period, to try and get a sense of what it was like to go to one of those hurly-burly experiences of sitting in the audience at a Shakespearean play.
That is not to rob it of its meaning.
No. That's to enrich and broaden its mm-hmm. meaning.
Tell me very briefly, Steve Mullaney, about affective domains, the project that you're working on here.
Yeah, this is an effort that really would span from the 16th century, where my former work has been, into the 18th century, really. And it's an effort to see where someone with a ground in literary studies, but an interest in other forms of historical studies, what one can do trying to ascertain the historical development of different forms of and means of expression of emotions.
Psychology.
It's a sort of historical psychology, although psychology is one of the fields I'm trying to stay away from right now, because it seems to me our answers are our answers psychologically.
So
I need to get back there.
What you're talking about here is not specifically nailing down the mindset of a particular person so much as the conditions that create the psychological commonalities that long dead people would have shared.
And how they changed over time. Norbert Elias, a sociologist in the 30s, suggested that at the time of the Reformation, something very significant happened to the nature of human emotions and how one felt about oneself in society.
I thought that was Virginia Woolf, and she put it in, what was it, sometime around 1940?
Well, it's always happening. Yeah. Elias suggested that you can trace in manuals of behavior in the period a sudden significant shift. Suddenly, we went from a culture which regarded blowing one's nose at the table, farting at the table as being not only okay, but medically salutary. I mean, it was against all medical lore not to expel whatever one needed to expel in whatever setting. And in a very brief span of time, that became the sort of taboo behavior that it is now. What Elias says is the threshold of shame and embarrassment changed quite significantly.
And this is what you call affective domains.
Yes, and if so, there should be ways of tracking other aspects of that.
Well, I want to wish you good luck on that project. Steve Mullaney, you're a professor of English at the University of Michigan. You are here at our Humanities Center working on this project with the working title Affective Domains. Your book is The Place of the Stage, published by the University of Chicago Press. Thanks for your contribution to Soundings. Good luck.
Thank you.
This is Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette copy of this week's program. The speakers were literary historians Linda Gregerson and Stephen Mullaney, both professors of English at the University of Michigan. Send $5 for a cassette copy of their comments, or $2 for a Soundings catalog. This week, the program number is 628. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. That's program number 628, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. The center welcomes your comments and suggestions. Next week, Empires of the Air, conversations about the origins and social importance of American broadcasting. Eli Rubenstein of UNC Chapel Hill will talk about his new book, Big World, Small Screen. Tom Lewis of Skidmore College will discuss his book, Empire of the Air, The Men Who Made Radio. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Politics, Sex, and Artistry in Elizabethan England, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Literary historians Linda Gregerson and Stephen Mullaney of the University of Michigan discuss gender, political power, and public artistry. The Virgin Queen, Shakespeare, and the Liberties of London. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings.